is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I think the biggest part of trying to build that foundation is to live by that code, and it has to be from the top down. So when you see your teammates, when you see your head coach, when you see your assistants all doing the right thing every time, that really breeds that culture where we're in this together, we're going to do it right. And those habits keep developing. So that contagious atmosphere is what we're trying to do in a positive manner.
Ryan Mee just completed his fifth season as the head men's basketball coach at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. In the 2021-2022 season, the Brewers won the Liberty League championship and earned their first NCAA tournament appearance in program history. Mee previously served as an assistant coach at Division I Davidson College in Davidson, North Carolina, under legendary head coach Bob McKillop from 2012 to 2018. Prior to Davidson, Mee was an associate head coach at his alma mater, the University of Rochester, from 2009 to 2012. During the 2008-2009 season, Mee was an assistant coach at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York. He began his coaching career at Hilbert College in 2005 before moving to Elmira College as an assistant coach for two seasons from 2006 to 2008. As a player, Mee was a four-year varsity letter winner at Rochester, serving as team captain in 2004-2005. He helped the Yellow Jackets to four NCAA tournament appearances as his squads went a combined 97-17 over his four seasons as part of the winningest class in the program's history. Hey, Hoopheads, this March, our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are offering $2,000 off the Dr. Dish All-Star, Rebel, and CT+. And don't forget their Anything Is Possible giveaway, too. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT+ models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details.
Hi, this is Tom Heil, head men's basketball coach at Baldwin-Wallace University, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Have your notebook handy as you listen to this episode with Ryan Mee, head men's basketball coach at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are pleased to be joined by Ryan Mee, the head men's basketball coach at Vassar College. Ryan, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thanks, Mike, for having me. Excited to be here.
Absolutely. We're thrilled to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do in your basketball career. Let's go back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of the first experiences that you had with the game.
Yeah, I was fortunate that my dad's a phys ed teacher. My mom's an elementary school teacher. So there were any type of balls in and around my crib when I was coming up. So I had an older brother. He was 13 years older than me, and my Corey and my sister Eileen was about 10 years older than me. So they were more aunts and uncles in terms, but able to teach me the game. So they would always play catch or wiffle ball, soccer, basketball. We played a little bit of everything. So that was the family routine, was going to the gym, because that was a really valuable asset to have keys to the gym to go play on Sundays for a little family time.
Did you know how lucky you were to have keys to the gym at that time?
Not at that time. Nope. I thought everybody's dad had keys to a big gym to play around in, and then realized how lucky I was.
When you think about that time and just being able to grow up and play multiple sports, and then you kind of think about the way that the game is today, where we have, and not just in the game of basketball, but obviously across all sports at the youth level, we sort of have this push towards specialization. When you think about just how you grew up playing multiple sports and playing with your siblings and obviously with your parents and their background, how do you think that influenced you as an athlete, just being able to play all those multiple sports?
Yeah, it makes you kind of like a rec league all-star or a valuable asset after your college playing career is done, because everybody wants you on their team for one of those rec leagues. But it's sad that I'm starting to see it with my children, as you mentioned before with yours, that I've already kind of went through a little bit, the pressures that they have in some of the youth sports to, you know, zone in on one. And I'm like, what are we doing? The amount of skills and that you're able to develop over different sports, I think really kind of it heightens your ceiling, you know, it raises it up. And if you're trying to specialize when you're, you know, before you're double digits or before you're 10 years old, I think that's a wild concept that kids are missing out on learning what they really could be great at.
It's hard, I think, when you look around, and I think so much of it comes from the adults that are involved versus if it was kid driven, I think a lot of kids just would prefer to just play in the driveway as opposed to going to an organized soccer practice three nights a week for 2 hours. But in a lot of cases, it's the only option that's out there because kids aren't just out playing in the neighborhood in the same way that they were before. And so then as parents, we see, okay, this family's doing this or this kid's playing on this team. And so then we kind of got to play catch up and make sure our kid's doing those same things. And it gets to be quite a challenge. When you think back to your experience with basketball, was there a time that you remember specifically where you decided, hey, I'm going to get a little bit more serious about the game? Or was it more of a gradual process where basketball kind of evolved into your number one thing?
Yeah, it was more fortunate enough to be like, we didn't, the only kids that played AAU for the most part when I was coming up in the like late 90s was, you know, the Albany City Rocks guys. And those were all D1s. And that was pretty much one of the few teams in New York State. So I played in a high school summer league. I had, you know, good experiences working with your teammates and what you would be trying to do in the season. And then I would be playing Legion baseball, and soccer was the one sport that I only played kind of in the season and to get in shape for hoops. But it wasn't until my senior year, I wasn't sure if I was playing baseball or basketball in college, but it was during basketball practice, you know, had a tough day at basketball practice and kind of walked out, which was tough because my dad was the coach. and it was in that little water break where I decided I was playing college hoops. And that's the tough part about coaching, right? You're depending on 18 to 25 year olds now pretty much for your livelihood. But those rational decisions, I was like, you know what? This December practice, my senior year of high school, I was like, I'm playing basketball in college.
What was it? What was that moment? Why that moment?
The frustration of like just wanting to be better, you know, and my teammates were pushing me in practice and yeah, never forget the day I was like, I ran through one of my teammates, Mark Gately, twice, and I was getting heckled, and it was a really funny experience because that like frustration just drove me. And I was like, you know what, we're playing basketball no matter what. I love the game, and I know I can be better at this.
So how'd you go about getting better? What was that process like from that moment until, and we'll talk a little bit about your recruitment and your college decision, but over the course of that time, how did you go about getting better? What was the plan?
I knew I wasn't a scholarship player. So Division III was my options, and a lot of the regional schools were there. But it was, they were recruiting me throughout. I was focused on, you know, after our basketball season, we went to baseball, which our team had more success in that. And, you know, just after that season finished, after baseball finished, was when, you know, taking some of those visits. But there wasn't any specific extra training during that time period. It was like, this is what we're going to do. And then during the summer, the workouts and everything kind of moving forward was focusing that energy on one sport. You know, after I was able to play multiple sports for up through all, my whole high school career.
What's your favorite moment as a high school basketball player?
Tough ones. I think it, you know, our arch rival is Greece Athena, which has had some like very good basketball players, John Wallace, and who's with the Kings right now, Anthony Lamb, came through there. Or not the Kings, the Warriors. My apologies. But we beat them in the first round of playoffs on their home court senior year, and it was just it's a really fun feeling beating an arch rival.
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing better than a high school rivalry game where, especially when you come out on top, those are always fun when the whole you get a bunch of the student body there and you got community members and all that stuff. Those games, there's nothing better than winning a rivalry game in high school. Talk about the decision to go to Rochester, a little bit about your recruitment. What was that like? And were there any lessons from what you went through that you've used over the course of time to kind of guide you as a coach in your recruiting?
I was fortunate to play for Mike Neer, who was a Hall of Fame caliber coach, had over 600 wins, won a national championship at Rochester, and the experience with that recruitment was he was being in the area. I grew up about 30 minutes from U of R's campus, and I thought I was going to go across the country somewhere. And my brother and sister went to Notre Dame. So thought I was, going to go somewhere far, play somewhere else. But the allure of having this national draw at the University of Rochester, have kids from all over the country at that school. And honestly, the gym, the Palestra is one of the nicest, kind of has its own character gym. And that combined with the academic piece was where I was sold. So little did I know kind of the path that would go once we got there. I think the team was 14-11 the year before, coming in as a freshman. And then we became the winningest class ever after 4 years. And to come in with such a strong group and go to two Final Fours, didn't really see that coming, but it was it made it very memorable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to be able to come in and have that kind of success, especially, as you said, coming off a season where the team was 14-11 and maybe that success was unexpected. What do you attribute that success to? What was it about the group of guys that you came in with that made them so special?
Good players. Yep.
Always helps, right?
Yeah. Seth Hauben was an All-American forward from Newton, Mass. And he had 39-18 in the Final Four, as a freshman. And we're like, okay. And had a point guard from Corpus Christi, Texas, Gabe Perez, who our coach Neer used the analogy more pulling guard than point guard, but he was one of the strongest, most athletic guys that I've played with. And we were just thankful Gabe was on our team. But those two players were able to gain some national recognition. And then the other pieces of our class, Brendan McAllister was another shooter that hit a shot to send us to the national championship game my senior year.
Coming in academically, what were you thinking about in terms of your career? Obviously, Rochester, great school from an academic standpoint. So as you come into school, what's your thought process in terms of where you think you want to go for a career? Or were you like most kids where you're kind of coming in going, I don't really know, I'm not sure what direction I want to go?
Yeah, that was the latter. And I wasn't sure exactly the direction. The curriculum at Rochester and actually now at Vassar is very similar in terms of having like this open curriculum where you can pick and choose things that you're interested in, and kind of gives you the free for all to figure it out instead of, sometimes I'm a little scared by some of the student athletes that are so smart but know exactly what they want to do at 18. And it's incredible how driven and focused students are now. But that was not me at that time. I was still trying to figure out what best fit me for that career path.
was coaching on your radar at all while you were still playing, or was it something that you didn't really come on to until after your playing career?
It was on my radar because that was in the family.
Right.
You know, my dad was a high school baseball and basketball coach. My brother was a college baseball coach. And it was more along the lines, I majored in economics. I was like, you know what? I'm not going into coaching. I'm going to be different again. And I'm, you know, my other family chose an outdoor sport. And I always say that I was the smarter one being from the Northeast.
Absolutely.
You know, being indoor. But I tried to fight the coaching aspect and kind of go into the business world. And then I realized I was miserable for the first 6 months that I tried that. So, that's
well,
where
you went 6 months longer than me because I went in and I, to be honest, coaching was never on my radar at all while I was playing. Uh-huh. And I got done with school. I had a business degree and both my parents were teachers. Mm-hmm. And so my dad was a professor at Cleveland State. My mom was an elementary school teacher. And so I got done. I graduated and started going on interviews. And I remember it was like in June after I graduated in May. And I had this interview with Nestle, the big food corporation.
Yeah.
And they offered me a job. And I started thinking, like, eh, you know, okay. You know, and then at some point they called me back and they're like, yeah, you know, you're going to start on July 1st. And I was like, what? They want me to put on a suit and go to work in July? Like, I've never seen anyone work in July in my entire life. I'm like, nah, we're not doing this. And so I went back to school and ended up getting a teaching degree. So yeah, it's amazing how quickly when reality strikes that you figure out, well, maybe going back and coaching might not be a bad deal. So talk a little about what your experience was like in the job market and then what prompted you to be like, hey, I got to go back and maybe get into coaching.
The coaching piece actually started a little bit my senior year in terms of I had an injury where I tore my ACL, but it was like I was never like a high flyer or I would shoot and I could feed the post and we had some good big men and guards that could get shots. But I was able to play my senior year without my ACL and we played until the last possible day and losing in the national championship game. But what helped me during that year, I started off, you know, starting, and then there were some players that, you know, were just better, some underclassmen that were able to kind of figure out what we needed to do. Like Jeff Geron is coaching at Suffolk University now, but like and Tim Brackney was two guards that I was trying to mentor while they were passing me by. And that really kind of been like, okay, I can coach that senior year. But those were the things that, hey, okay, I'm going to look at this job. I got a job at Guardian, you know, life insurance after it was in this group sales. And I was not as happy as I could be. So I volunteered at Hilbert College for that season with Rob DeGrampy, who I've known for a while. And he, it was great. I was doing everything. And that was the happiest part of my day. Was, you know, doing laundry or doing scout or at practice and then trying to find a school to pay for my master's and find a graduate assistant job. And I was able to catch on at Elmira College down with Chris Connolly. And, you know, if you're talking about that transition to coaching in your first year, you have a really rough year with a lot of freshmen and you don't win many games. That was the gut check that needed, hey, that wasn't that fun. But, you know, I still want to do this. And those relationships with the players and obviously the coaching staff and just seeing it on the other side really solidified what I was doing the rest of my life.
What did you love about it right away? Like, what was the one thing that you're like, if you had to point to it, say, man, this is what I love about coaching. This is what really draws me in and makes me want to keep doing this.
Yeah, the teaching aspect, you know, and being able to see players apply what you've taught and then instantly see that trust in you kind of build, be like, oh, that worked, you know, like, and see the light bulb go on is really, really fun. And just watching the progression of them from you know, boys to young men and being ready for realizing some of the stuff you've been preaching actually applies to their life and will help them through some of the adversity when the real world comes. That's the most rewarding part.
I think that's something that when you look at what is one of the most underrated parts of coaching, I think that ability to translate lessons that they learn on the basketball floor into lessons in life, I think that's something that the good coaches really do well. And you mentioned earlier talking about building the relationships with your players. And I think those two things go hand in hand. When you build that relationship, now that gives you the ability to utilize basketball as a way to impact them not only on the floor, but also in life. And I think that that's something that all coaches, especially today, I think more so than ever, coaches strive for that and are really working to try to get to that point where they can have that influence again, not just on the floor, but off the floor as well. When you think back to this time where you're volunteering and then you're a GA and you're obviously doing a lot of work and spending a lot of time around basketball for very little money, what kind of advice would you give to somebody? Because we have a lot of guys, I think, that are out there that are sort of in the early stages of their career that are part of our audience that are listening. And so if you had to give some advice to somebody who's kind of starting out their career, they want to be a college coach, they're maybe just graduating from school, they're trying to figure it out, what kind of advice would you give them based on your experiences?
It's to find good people, ask questions, and try to just get out. And I was fortunate to meet a lot of good people through my playing kind of experience, and then, you know, get in and interview a little bit earlier for some coaching kind of aspects. But I think that working camp and building relationships that way was very helpful, to try to go work a camp, email, ask questions, hey, can I go to a practice, and being around. It's tough when you're in the volunteer role to really you got to go all in and just kind of put 2 feet in if you're lucky enough to have like a support system or build up some savings, and you're going to take a hit kind of financially, but that is what would separate you from, you know, being there a few days and trying to get as much responsibility as you can early, and continue to build that trust with the head coach is going to be valuable. It's kind of the only way that'll separate you, because you have so many friends and colleagues that got into coaching early, but you know, real life hit them and they weren't able to stay in it. So I consider myself very fortunate to kind of be able to keep it afloat, and then, you know, have family and my wife and family take care of me so we can still do this job, right? So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. How did you balance when you were a GA? How did you balance the workload of class with coaching? Talk a little bit about that.
I mean, it's easier in hindsight now, but it's so easy when it's just you.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that crazy?
And I got schoolwork, and then hoops is the only other thing that you're working on. So it was a decent day. I got my master's in education from Elmira. It was a good, great experience being able to get in the classroom, some online classes. But that gave that flexibility, because most of the classes were, you know, in the evening and or meeting once a week where we could work around practice. So that wasn't as big of a challenge as I was, because it was in the education piece and the hours didn't conflict that hard.
How important was it, do you think, early in your career to have the experiences that you did where you kind of got to put your hand into a lot of different areas, like you mentioned? Because we've talked to different people on the podcast where some of them started out at the D3 level, where obviously there's not as big of a staff, where you have more responsibility in lots of different areas. And then we've talked to other guys that maybe have started out as a GA at a Division I program where there's less responsibility just because there's more people on the staff. You don't get to do as many different things as somebody who starts at a lower level. So talk a little bit about how you feel like you were able to benefit from having this experience where you're doing a whole bunch of things. How has that helped you over the course of your career?
It's priceless. To be able to have to dive into everything. And that's what I was able to do at Elmira, at the grad assistant, because I was the only other assistant there with Chris. And it was, you're doing your scouts, you're being able to be kind of on that academic side of things and checking in on guys, making sure that we're doing our schoolwork, your all the recruiting pieces. It's the film, film editing, scout presentation, you know, pregame walkthrough. You're doing all that. And I can't tell you how valuable that is for your development to get out there and do it. Because I went in that reverse route in terms of like was able to have 7 years in D3 coaching before going to Davidson. And then that was when I felt like my knowledge of the basketball piece really kind of went through the roof, because that was your only responsibility. It wasn't, you know, game management or, you know, I was the club sports supervisor at the University of Rochester. Some secondary duties that might take away from hoops. That's where it was great to like have that Renaissance man kind of experience with all the other things that go into the college experience in Division III, and then to also get a peek at the Division I and the running that bigger program and the specifics of that was also incredibly valuable. But Division III is where I'm at and where I love to, you know, like that experience is so much different than some of the Division I experiences right now.
Talk about the difference in the two experiences, because I'm just curious from somebody who's been a coach at both of those levels, because I look at the experience in a bunch of different ways, and it's been a long time. I'm going to be 53 here in a week. And so my Division I playing experience is a long time ago, but it was clearly different, because when my season ended, I was handed like a 2-page ditto and said, here's your workout. We'll see you back in August. Whereas now, obviously, that is not the case. And sometimes I look at what coaching staffs and players do, and they're on campus 50 weeks a year, and you're just hearing the same voices over and over again. And part of me is like, God, I don't know how anybody does that on either side of the equation, players or coaches. And then obviously on the Division III level, you have almost the polar opposite, where you guys can't even have almost no contact. You can't almost say hello to your players in the off season. So just talk and compare and contrast some of those differences that you see, and just kind of how it impacts your experience as a coach and a student athlete's experience.
Yeah. There's, which one should I do first? The coaching side of it?
Sure.
And,
sure.
Yeah, we'll go there first. Just the coaching D3 is that you are, you know, the person that it's going to run through in terms of, don't have a sports marketing department. So I got to make this graphic and put this up for our team game and run social media. We got to make sure that we're cutting up this film. Oh, you know, our laundry facilities at some schools, you might be doing that, and you might not have somebody that's doing the equipment managing. So like just being ready for absolutely anything that comes your way. And that's what we ask our student athletes to figure out on the court. Right. And so like, if somebody's going crazy today that doesn't usually shoot it that well, we got to adjust and adapt. And, that's kind of what the coaching aspect of Division III is, in terms of, oh, this thing fell, we got to fix it right away. And at Division I, the coaching kind of piece, and as far as the timeline, like you're not allowed to see your players or work with them in the gym until October 15th. Is usually the Division III start date. And then after our season's done, like our season just ended last week. And you know, we're limited in seeing them in the gym for the rest until next October. So we're having some individual meetings now just to wrap up the season and talk about, you know, some goal setting and stuff. But it's wild. The kids that want to get in the gym, and we have to tell them no because of some of the NCAA rules. It's tough in some aspects, but that separating factor allows the students to really kind of run off and kind of chase any of their other experiences or interests that they want on campus. So we have a number of guys involved in different clubs or activities that, you know, are preparing them for life after basketball. And that's what's really fun coaching at a high academic, D3, is to watch, like, we're talking with some guys that can help kind of make the world a better place, and,
right,
instead of just, you know, kind of get a degree. So I'm counting on them to keep running with how smart and driven they are. And then flip that to the Division One kind of side of things, where you have your preseason, where you have your 2 hours a week to be able to work with guys. You have your varsity strength coach that they're with multiple times. And then you're eventually able to get some team workouts in. And then, yes, now practice starts. And then you go through the season, and then you have your postseason workouts. And then now, like, it was just when I was transitioning out is when more approvals for summer school, instead of like 4 weeks, it went to 8 weeks, and the consistency there. And it was just starting to go to the cost of living fee structure was coming. And now the NIL kind of beast that is making it, you know, there's a lot of things that aren't just basketball anymore, which makes it, you know, it makes me happy. I'm coaching Division III and getting to deal with, you know, a student athlete that plays for the love of the game, because our NIL deals that we're trying to work out here are getting you a free burger, you know, at the local shop. So
yeah, absolutely.
Really fun, because you don't have to get lost in the weeds and some of the other things that are going on. But the employee feeling really comes around. I was fortunate enough to be at Davidson College, which is Coach McKillop is a Hall of Fame coach. Taught me so much just about basketball, about being, you know, a leader, and how to communicate with people from all different kind of aspects or backgrounds. And yeah, he was fantastic in teaching us how to do it. And it works, because it is a little bit like Davidson's this bubble in Pleasantville place where, you know, all the shots go in, and everybody's incredibly kind. And so it's and so that is, like, you find these outliers of places, and Coach McKillop combined with the atmosphere of Davidson College, and it's an incredible place, and excited to see his son Matt continue to carry on that McKillop tradition there.
All right, I want to get into that in a second. Let's talk about coaching at your alma mater. And then, obviously, it's clear from your discussion and kind of the what you're talking about and your past experience that you love the Division III level. So then we're going to get to the decision to go when you get the opportunity at Davidson, how that comes your way. But first, talk a little bit about just what it was like to coach at your alma mater and how special that was, and maybe how – I don't know. It always feels like to me when you go back and coach at your alma mater, when you talk to guys that do that, that there's an adjustment period to be made, because you're kind of used to being in that program as a player. And even though you're transitioning and you're now a coach, it's still kind of like you're going behind the curtain of what you didn't see when you were a player. So just talk about what that was like to be coaching at your alma mater.
Yeah, it was great. I remember when I actually asked the coach I played for, like, I'm like, "Coach, I might want to get into coaching." And he's like, "No, you don't." And just challenged me right away. And that was my hope, was to be able to coach at my alma mater. But that's not the way it worked out, right? So I went to Hilbert, Elmira, and then was able to have a job after my master's at Skidmore College for a year with Luke Fakirti, who's actually the head coach at Rochester now. So it was one of those scenarios where I was with him for a year, and then it was 4 years out is when Coach Neer was able to hire me back. And I didn't understand it at the time, but to get those different experiences and then come back to your alma mater only makes you that much more valuable and you know, a better understanding of things, and gives you separation from the current team. So that was really an amazing experience, because I was able to, it was Coach Neer's last year. I think it was his 34th year at Rochester. And it was great. Got to work for a year with him. And it's the easiest thing to sell is something you bought, right? So the recruiting pitch and just the diving into, you know, the players there and trying to make their experience better than what yours was, that's exactly what we were able to do. So we continued to build the program. And then my second year there was Luke Flaherty came from Skidmore to Rochester to get the job. And we won the UAA in our second year there with a kid who's still playing professionally, John DeBartolomeo, over at Maccabi Tel Aviv. He's the captain of their team. So like, why did we win some good, you know, coaching, but more important, just had some special players that came together for that one. So, yeah, you can't put a price on, you know, buying and selling something that you bought. So like, that was awesome to be back at Rochester as a coach.
Tell people a little bit about the UAA for maybe some people out there in the audience that aren't familiar with it. What makes it such a unique league?
Yeah, it's the airplane league, or just being able to fly. You know, you have Emory in Atlanta, Chicago, Wash U in St. Louis, and then Case Western, Carnegie Mellon, all these research universities in different cities, and you play on Friday night, and then you travel to the next city. So if we were at Brandeis in Boston, then you travel down to NYU the next day. So, and then you play on Sunday. So we play Sunday at noon, and that's wild for college basketball games. People used to just think that was only for AAU, but we would play a noon game so we could fly home on that Sunday.
Yep.
And then be able to get back to class on Monday. So it was a really unique experience that, you know, your first couple of years, you're so excited to get on the road and see all these cities. And then in junior and senior year, like, just let's stay home. let's please just play at home.
Understood. All right. Tell me about the opportunity to go to Davidson. How does that come to be? And then was it an easy decision or a tough decision to leave your alma mater?
That situation, like time and place, just I was in the right situation. One of my teammates and then former coach is Tim Sweeney, who's now at Connecticut College. He got the job as an assistant coach at Davidson right in 2006, right after I graduated. And so it happened to be somebody's freshman year who's, you know, still doing pretty well. Steph Curry was there as an incoming freshman. So I go down there to work camp and hang out with my friend Tim, and you get to meet some of the people and see kind of them continue to develop. They went to the NCAA tournament that year and lost to Maryland in the first round, but then went to that camp again. This is and for the next 8 years, I took the trip from Rochester and drove down to Davidson, North Carolina. It was about 11 hours or so. And we would bring some friends and different, you know, coaching peers. And we would come down because Coach McKillop invests in that camp experience. And he's there every day giving lectures. And, you know, we learned so much just how to kind of speak to groups and be able to engage in the community that, even when Tim went on to work with Dave Paulson at Bucknell after Steph, after that Elite Eight run, I kept going to Davidson and continued to just learn from Coach McKillop. And somehow that led to an opportunity after our year in 2012. We got a call from one of my assistants, Jim Fox, saying, "Hey, Ryan, would you be interested in a coaching position here if it opens up?" And at that time, I was scheduled to marry my wife, Ania, in August. That call came in May. And so we ended up having a destination wedding in Rochester, New York, as we moved down to Davidson. So when that opportunity came up, it was, you know, just checking in with my wife, making sure we were good for this. And just to give you an idea of how the interview process for that, Coach McKillop hopped on a plane and came to see us, but he wanted to make sure he was interviewing my wife, Ania, as well. So he met with us both in the airport, and then flew back to Charlotte. He just went out, and that's one of the biggest boss moves I've ever seen by an amazing coach, but that really is valuing that family first and making sure everybody's bought in to what's going on. So that was my oh wow moment in that whole interview process.
Did your wife know what she was getting into when you guys first got together?
A little bit. There was a little bit of a recruiting pitch on that.
Okay,
but she knew a little bit about the coaching world. And our first conversation was about Syracuse basketball because she was her family were season ticket holders. So that got me in. So she's always loved athletics, and so she had a little bit of an idea, but not as much.
Who's your favorite intense Syracuse player?
Dion Waiters is who we were talking about that first
all right,
conversation.
Cleveland so guy. There you go.
Yeah,
Cleveland guy.
Yeah.
All right.
So he was mine, but like Ryan Blackwell or John Wallace for some of our Rochester guys in background of guys who really had a good career there.
Gotcha. All right. So when you get to Davison, tell us a little bit about your role. What were you doing there?
I was the third assistant on staff, and that's what makes Coach so good. We had responsibilities for everything. So trying to produce more head coaches and get guys that know how to run a program. So doing everything from that, you know, a director of ops would be doing to try to plan some of the travel, to scout prep, to individual workouts, film sessions, all of those things. And, you know, those staff meetings were great for us to keep developing as individuals and still specialize. The special teams was something that I really kind of had a little bit more of a responsibility for. And when we say special teams in hoops, that's the baseline out of bounds or sideline out of bounds, free throws, you know, when that dead ball of how can we get an edge. And that was something Coach did such a great job of, you know, emphasizing and how to try to get that edge. So pointing out the Patriots or whenever, when they're winning those Super Bowls by one or two possessions, you know, hey, special teams got that win. So our team was talking about it this year when, you know, they missed a field goal in that college football playoff. So it translates a lot.
Absolutely. All right. Biggest difference between your Division III experience up to that point and Division I, what adjustments did you have to make sort of in your approach, your mentality? Obviously, you're more specialized, as we talked about before, in what you're doing. But just what do you remember about the differences maybe in those first couple months as you get there?
Yeah, the sense of urgency, just continuing to pick up and, you know, the investment in each player. And it's easier on the recruiting side in Division III in terms of like, hey, everybody has like a little bit different situation. You're paying money to come to our school. If it works for you, great. On the scholarship side of things, you know, I feel like there's, you know, everybody is able to offer a scholarship in most situations. And that creates a little bit more of this like silo feeling and less camaraderie across the coaches. So like in terms of, you know, the competition, so you feel like you're always trying to keep some secrets or get an edge in certain ways. And that was something that, I mean, some of my best friends are from the Division III side of things and opposing coaches of guys that were on the road recruiting, knowing that, you know, we're going to recruit this kid as hard as he can, but it's his decision. And then the scholarship side of things, you know, make that a little bit different. But the other jump was just, yeah, physicality. Guys just being able to be a little bit bigger, faster, stronger, and being able to hold the pad and take a good hit. You know, so I had to keep making sure I was lifting weights and working out so I didn't get leveled.
What about on the recruiting side of it, adapting to figuring out what level of player, what type of player, what the skill level has to be? What's the adjustment? Like, I'm always curious to talk to guys when they go from one level to another, because obviously, okay, you've been at the Division III level. You've kind of narrowed in on this is the type of player that we're looking for in our program. This is the type of player that can play and excel at this level. And now you jump up to Division I level and you're looking at a whole different set of players. What's that like in terms of the learning curve, trying to figure that out?
It's wild. It is. And now more than ever, it's the most confusing airspace you could get into with the COVID years and the transfer rules. But like it's just the consistency, I think, is besides being the strength and to be able to handle some of the things, but especially at a place like Davidson, it was, you know, trust in your eyes in terms of what you're seeing. Are they being able to produce it? How are they, you know, shooting the ball, handling it? Do they make their teammates better? But some of those little things, and then to realize that scholarship level, you know, is that consistency factor of, are they doing it every time? Or are they able to do it, you know, 3 out of 5 times? So those were the things that I really kind of got a better feel for. And of course, you're like, hey, this kid looks pretty good. And like in recruiting Kevin Herter, who was from up our way, out of Shen High School in the Albany area. And we're like, you know, yeah, I think this kid's going to be great for us. And he grows 3 inches and, you know, he's going to Maryland and playing and getting some decent money now. There were a lot of those instances where you're on guys that blow up in that, you know, one AAU weekend, or they just, you know, kind of go on. And then there's others that you're trying to keep alive that might be okay, but you know what? They're not exactly what we need right now, but if we don't have anybody, and it's funny just to see how thin that margin for error is of a kid that's, you know, going to a Power Five versus, you know, a Patriot or Ivy. And then the Southern Conference was tougher. It got a little bit easier when we jumped to the Atlantic 10 in terms of drawing those kids and trying to convince, hey, you know, maybe the bottom of an ACC or, you know, there's another academic school might not be as fun if you're not able to compete in March. And that's what, you know, was hopefully that sales pitch to try to get guys to have that opportunity to play and be able to play in the March Madness.
Yeah, I can't even imagine now with the portal and everything else that goes along with that and trying to figure it out. It just seems like it's a mess. And I've talked to guys that some of them have a really high opinion of the portal and what it's done. And then you talk to other people and, you know, they feel the complete opposite. And I just think it adds a whole nother layer of challenge of trying to figure out what guys can, we can obviously rebuild very quickly with guys who have a track record of performing at the college level. And, you know, then you think about the impact that it's had on high school recruiting and all those kinds of things. And I know we're jumping ahead here, but I think this is a good time to talk a little bit about just your recruiting process at Vassar. I want to get back to how you get the job and all that, but let's talk a little bit about the recruiting piece of it. When you guys are putting together your list of preliminary players that you want to start to look at, just take me through the process from start to finish. Like, how do you initially identify your first list of whatever, 25 guys or 50 guys or whatever that list is that you want to look at? And then just talk about the process of kind of paring that down until you eventually get to guys that you bring on campus.
Yeah, it's casting a wide net. Luke Flacurzi, who kind of mentored me at Skidmore and then at Rochester, you know, did a great analogy of, you know, recruiting is trying to make sure you have this huge funnel. And you're just as the student athletes are putting lots of schools in there, the coaches are putting a lot of names in there. And then it continues to dwindle down, whether it's, you know, the financial aid piece, if it's the academic standards to get in admissions, if it's location, all that just makes that funnel continue to dwindle down until hopefully you have a reasonable set of guys who might potentially be a good fit for your institution. And then that's what we're trying to do. And some of the most efficient ways for us to do that, since we don't have, you know, those recruiting budget that allows you to recruit as nationally as we need to be, we go to a lot of the Ivy League camps. They'll have prospect camps, Patriot League at times, and then now some of the own Division III schools are also having these prospect camps. And what that does is helps us kind of target those student athletes who understand, you know, the financial aid piece and the financial commitment that would happen for them at some of these schools and their desire to be at a high academic school. So that just makes it, you know, I go to an AAU tournament and the majority of the, you know, we got a 18% acceptance rate. You know, I'm not getting too many people in and it's right. not being efficient. So it's going into that process with using some of those other resources that we have to find players who want that. And luckily, you know, Yale can't take everybody. And you know, some of the other schools that the Division III level at the high academic standards, we're able to find some student athletes that would absolutely thrive and are really valuing the opportunity to make an impact on the court. And so that's where we've had some real success is finding some of those guys that, you know, and might even have a chip on their shoulder. If their number one choice, you know, says, you know, our roster's full, we don't have them. I just tell our guys, hey, I'm happy to get them on the schedule for us. So that's continued to make our guys work hard and, you know, have that little edge that's hopefully going to continue to help us keep growing.
So how much do you weigh when you're evaluating a player? How much do you weigh their performance if you're watching them once you've had them identified, you know that maybe there's some mutual interest and they have the academics to be able to get into school? How much do you weigh their performance in AAU versus their performance versus in high school versus what you see if you go to, you know, one of the prospect camps?
Great, good question. In terms of like, we want to get our eyes on them, so seeing them live is very important. And then we got to just trust what we saw and take very, you know, good notes while we see them live, and then follow up with film. And then we need to vet them in the process and, you know, talk to high school coaches, AU coaches, you know, anybody that'll, you know, listen to us and then call us back. But I want to know, hey, how's this person treat their trainers? You know, like, and that human aspect of something is so important to find guys that'll be great fits, not only on their court, but in the locker room and with your current nucleus. So those pieces are really important. But the AAU versus the high school, whatever video they're able to send us, in most occasions is where we're at. We might get to one or two AAU tournaments, but usually when you can watch a guy a few times, you have a decent idea. Hey, there's some potential here. We need to dive in deeper. And that's when we'll continue to follow up. But if we like someone, usually off that initial one or two views, we'll encourage them to get to campus. Hey, are you coming out to the Northeast, you know, to visit some schools? Great. Tell us when. We'll be there, give you a campus tour, you know, get a chance to talk with you about the program. So that's usually our process, is just that, hey, when are you available? Oh, you're coming to visit three schools out here. Swing by ours, and that'll give you a good kind of baseline. Hey, you got an urban school, you know, a little bit more of a rural school, and then the in-between. So that's what I try to encourage the guys who are recruiting to go see, just to see what they like and don't like.
How many guys do you like to bring in a typical class, if there is such a thing as a typical class?
Yeah, it's usually like four would be great, four in, four out. And you get that roster size around 16. We were insanely high on the senior side this year. My first recruiting class when I was here just graduated. So that was 10 seniors. So,
oh, wow.
And it was, you know, we're getting back to baseline next year in terms of trying to even out these classes. So we took a little bit more. Last year or the year before, we took an extra person to try to level it out and just carry a higher roster size for two seasons. So wow is the correct answer to that.
All right, let's work backwards and tell me a little bit about what you learned as an assistant at Davidson under Coach McKillop that you've taken with you that's made you a better head coach for your assistants, both present and future?
Yeah, there's a ton that I could put in here, but the core kind of values as you're developing your coaching philosophy? You know, everybody asks you that question when you're a younger coach. You're focused on, hey, it's these, you know, the X's and O's, and I got to get all this kind of just prove that I know what I'm talking about. And then, you know, that light bulb clicked when I was with Coach McKillop in terms of like just the core values. You know, you see it on kind of Steph's wrist, or if it's that TCC, or that trust, commitment, and care has been the foundation of, you know, Coach McKillop's program throughout. And you got to trust yourselves, those around you. You have to be able to care. You got to be committed to being your best and care about those around you. And not just, you know, kind of say you care, but show you care. And when you talk to your team about that being your core values, and you know, it helps you when you're faced with these situations that you might not be ready for. Because if you stick to that, you're going to be in good shape, no matter if it's on the court or in life. And that's why, you know, you see so many people just in that program, they wear it on their chest, or they have, you know, they live by that little code, and it puts you in good places. So that developing that coaching philosophy foundation and giving you some of these things to prepare you for the unexpected, that was the biggest takeaway that I had from Coach.
What does that look like on the ground? So when you talk about those words and you say, these are our core values, I think one of the things that I always find to be fascinating is how do coaches take those words and then on a day-to-day basis demonstrate what trust looks like among teammates or between the coaching staff and players, or however you want to phrase that with whatever relationship. But just what are some things that you saw that made that concrete for the players and then the coaches on Coach McKillop's staff?
Just putting yourself out there in 100% in terms of, you know, being able to kind of perform your task of what you're doing, you know, ask questions, and knowing that you're there for like the team aspect. And then it shows, because as we talk with our team, you know, decision making, you know, shots falling, all of that is kind of contagious. And if it could go good, it could go in a good direction. Or, you know, if people are making some bad decisions, then other people might not, you know, be holding themselves to that higher standard. And it might be like, oh, if Billy's not doing it, maybe I got to go over here and I can slack off a little bit. So I think the biggest part of trying to build that foundation is to live by that code, and it has to be from the top down. So when you see your teammates, when you see your head coach, when you see your assistants all doing the right thing every time, you know, like that really kind of breeds that culture where, you know, but hey, we're in this together, we're going to do it right. And those habits keep developing. So that contagious atmosphere is what we're trying to do in a positive manner.
Yeah, that's powerful stuff when you can see it by example day after day after day after day. And when these situations arise, that people are always handling them in a specific way and everybody sees that, it just reinforces, as you said, it makes it something that it almost becomes second nature, that this is just the way things are and nobody has to even really think about it or talk about it because it's just been established. And I think then when you get your program to that point as a coach, I think that's when obviously you've really got something, and the success that Coach McKillop's had at Davidson obviously speaks for itself. The first training camp Elite Skill Development and Performance Combine will be held on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, powered by Unleash Potential and the Hoopheads podcast. The camp is designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9 and will take place June 29th through July 1st, 2023. An emphasis on improving individual skills in the context of a team environment will be the hallmark of the training camp. Mike Klinzing from Head Start Basketball and the Hoopheads podcast and Joe's Decision from Unleashed Potential will serve as the camp directors of this inaugural training camp. Campers can expect 3 days of hard work, intense skill instruction, and learning how to be a great teammate on and off the court at the training camp. Players will participate in 10 elite skill development sessions led by some of the best coaches from across the country. Visit headstartbasketball.com to get registered. Tell me a little bit about the opportunity to go to Vassar. When the job opens up, is it one that you immediately know, hey, I'm going to apply for this? Is it more a case of somebody reaches out to you and say, hey, this job's going to open up, maybe you should consider it? Just what was the process for getting you from Davidson to Vassar?
No, it was something that was important for me and my family to try to find a head coaching position, preferably a little bit closer to home as we were starting to grow our family. And had some interview opportunities at some other schools, but it was when, you know, pulling onto Vassar's campus and seeing how much of like a, it's like a movie screen, like they shoot different shows there and movies, you know, on campus because it's so beautiful. And then to have kind of the academic piece and then beautiful court and you're working at an institution, you're only going to be as good as the kind of the support that you have, you know, from that institution and the administration. And it was a great kind of atmosphere and feeling from the athletic director up to the president in terms of, hey, we can do both. We can be excel at academics and in the athletic realm. And that was, I was sold and hoping to get that job as soon as I showed up on campus for the interview. Those things were were great to see and see it come true.
What was the most important question or questions that you had for them about taking the job, the support of the staff, of the administration, of building the program, or just what were the questions that you asked them?
It wasn't any specific questions. It was being there, you know, in terms of, and just watching how, you know, the current coaches were being, you know, handled, and BJ Dunn is, who's now at Gettysburg and doing great there. We did have a relationship as we came up together in the coaching field. So when he was able to take that Gettysburg job, you know, conversing with him and about, you know, what Vassar is and the situation and how it's heading in the right direction, that was obviously built up a lot of trust too. So it's fun to see us kind of keep growing in that aspect. But the people, you know, Michelle Walsh was a three-sport athlete at Swarthmore, and our president, Betsy Bradley, was, you know, captain of the squash team. So you're just like, all right, we got some competitors and that are going to try to be successful. So that's what sold me.
When you get on campus and you start looking around and you're figuring out what you need to do, what were some of the first things that you felt were the most important in those early days of having the job to get the program going in the direction that you wanted it to be going?
It was, for me, it was to try to not pick up too many other kind of extra, like as much as I wanted to try to help out in a certain, you know, a different forum, or there's a group talking here. I wanted to invest as much as I could in the current team and just try to set the standard about what we're trying to do and continue to just keep developing and having those minor goals or daily objectives, being able to try to get a little bit better each day. And my assistant at the time, who's now the head coach at Purchase, Dan Bozzelli, constantly reminded me, hey, there's no skipping steps. You know, there's no, you know, so to not assume that we got it, to continue to build the habits and do the small things, because there's no kind of real elevators there. And you just got to keep taking each step and then good things are going to happen.
Biggest adjustment going from being an assistant to being a first-time head coach?
Yeah, it all lies with you in terms of setting the tone and being able to, you know, make that suggestion or to do what you've been suggesting for the last, you know, 13 years. And, oh, all right, I get to do it. But that's the fun part. And then like the adjustment of, you know, not being able just to to do the coaching piece, and then how much other things get kind of in the way and responsibilities you have, where you're thrilled when you get to practice and just get to do practice and not have all some of the other things that come from off the court or other responsibilities you may have. That was the biggest surprise of like where your time gets taken away and you're not coaching as much as sometimes you were as an assistant coach.
I know you talked earlier about sort of getting your philosophy down and understanding what you wanted to do and how you wanted to build your program. But when you get that job and you come in and now you're actually doing it for real and you're standing in front of your players and you're talking to administration, you're really actually building that program and putting it into what you want it to become. How do you feel like sort of your ideas of what you wanted to do when you came in before you got the job or as you were thinking about and preparing for becoming a head coach, how does that vision of maybe what you had before you became the head coach, how close is it to what's actually transpired once you have the job, if that question makes any sense at all?
Yeah. It's always a little bit, you know, going to be different than you exactly how you planned it, but it's been as far as like what we're trying to do. Yeah. Did I want to play faster, you know, with a better pace? Yes. But like trying to adapt with what you have and to try to get the best out of the pieces that you currently have on your roster and team. Like we played a little bit slower, you know, you invest in defense because, that's what's going to help you advance in March. And originally you're thinking, hey, we're just going to do this offensively and try to outscore people. But it's that's without scholarships, you're trying to get the best players that you can and work with them to play to their strengths. And so that's where I would say I didn't, you know, foresee that as much. Or that might have been one of the surprises of trying to hold true to your core values and what you're not going to sacrifice, but you do have to tweak it based on what's actually available and what's best for your team and program each year.
So going into a season, as you're starting to plan your first few weeks of preseason practice, what does that process look like for you and your staff? What are some of the things that you're talking about? What are some of the things that you're trying to put together? Are you writing out, typing out a week's worth of practice plans? Just what's the process like for preparing for a season in the month or so before you guys open up on October 15th?
Yeah, you're just giddy, right? Because you're so excited.
I get so, it.
But the piece, yeah, you've planned out, you have a checklist. You know, hey, we want to make sure we're doing this every day. We have this piece that we need to be able to get to, and just making sure you get that the first couple of weeks of practice and make sure, hey, I'm ready to do this for a scrimmage. Like this year, it was a little bit different because we took an international trip. So we took those 10 days and you're like, oh, crap, I got to get to this a little bit faster to make sure we're ready to play a couple games. And so that's where, you know, your rollout is a little bit different, but not skipping the steps, as we mentioned before, and making sure we slow down a little bit to get the details of our defensive, you know, stance or slides or your communication, to make sure your vernacular and your language, everybody's on the same page, you know, have a terminology sheet to share with your players just to make sure, you know, we're all in the same, you know, atmosphere of the same language. And that's something that helps kind of speed up the process. If you're able to try to do some of that or have your players teaching your players, that's where the biggest jumps have occurred here at Vassar's. Once that was starting to occur, you know, you don't have to waste as many days, you know, getting in shape or getting people, you know, familiar with some of the initial actions of your offense.
How important is it, and it kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier in terms of the rules in Division III, and obviously you talked about how you're having your postseason meetings with players now. How important is it to have strong leadership from your players so that you know you can count on those guys to get those messages across and help them to help other players understand the terminology and just get guys in the gym. How important is that player led situation in terms of Division III compared to maybe other levels?
It's everything. Like if you want to have, you know, some separating factors, it's your leadership from your team members. And, you know, everybody kind of knows that when you have people patrolling the locker room and being able to hold each other accountable on a player standpoint, that's when real greatness happens. Like coaches are only able to do so much when you have that intrinsic motivation and that those friendships and relationships to hold your peers accountable. That's when, you know, special happens. And so we're constantly trying to develop that, to communicate with each other about, hey, what would you have done differently here? You know, and that self, trying to be selfless and explain to our, you know, our players and our program members of like, hey, it doesn't mean thinking less of you, your value. It's just thinking about yourself less. And like those things are so important when we're trying to help each other kind of move forward. You can't do it by yourself. And we're hoping some of our underclassmen are getting that message and understanding how important it is to, you know, step up in their leadership roles as, you know, we have our 10 seniors graduating. So it's more important than ever right here at Vassar in Poughkeepsie, New York.
How do you develop that leadership during the season? What are some things that you do? How do you give your players opportunities to lead within your team so that they can grow and grow into that role that you want them to be as a leader?
Trying to make everybody feel, you know, that valued and to kind of carve out some roles. We always are trying to watch, you know, some individual film or having some meetings. And that's one thing I think I had more of this year, because I think that we did have, after some injuries, you know, when you're better, you know, your player of the year is down. How are you going to fill that void and have some other guys step up? And so our team continues to fight and did an excellent job in that. But it's trying to set up those individual meetings to make sure everybody is seeing the same thing. And if they're not, they can ask those questions in terms of, you know, and I can have a better understanding of what they're seeing, you know. So that's where I think we both grow, if we're able to make that time for each other, because that's helping build that trust factor, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you can have those conversations and be candid and allow the player space to be able to ask questions, I think now you're heading in the right direction where you have those open lines of communication. And then that's ultimately where you're getting to, where you build that trust. And that's really how you build leadership and how you make sure that the players trust that you as the coach have their back, have their best interest at heart. And then that allows you to coach them hard when you have that kind of relationship that you can push them and try to get the most out of them and help your team to have as much success as you possibly can. When you think about what you do every day on the practice floor, talk a little bit about how your practices are organized. Do you have a set sort of rotation of how you go through things, like offense first, defense first, special teams first? Just how do you organize a practice?
Yeah, and it's constantly evolving. You know, I still use the same format that my college coach used, in terms of it's on the same, you know, Word document. So I'm not, it's trying to get the guys moving first with like a dynamic stretch, and then maybe some passing and handling, you know, trying to get some shots up a little bit earlier. And then more so than ever is trying to just develop those skills in a play while playing. In the past, I've tried to break down some of the actions before, but I feel like especially this year moving forward, it's trying to have them learn kind of on the fly and be able to coach them what would be in a game situation, where you're trying to be able to get them to learn some of the details. And then for what's not gathered, you have to come back and visit it via like a film session or some of those meetings, you know, when you're not able to address it in the midst of practice. But trying to play as much as possible, shooting, and you know, practicing some of the defensive rotations or actions. Those are what we're trying to go back and forth of throughout the game. So it's practice is so fun, and trying to get your guys to think it's fun too. That's where we're at in terms of, hey, we're not going to make you do it 1,000 times. We're going to explain to you why it's important to us to try to help us win and get better as a team. And you got to have that drive to do it well, and then we'll move on to the next thing. And we're not going to do it for 5 hours of, you know, just without a ball or playing the game that you love.
How do you utilize your staff during practice?
Yeah, I've been fortunate with a full-time assistant to be able to give them as much responsibility as they can handle. So they're doing a lot. So if it's, they're running the scout team, they're, you know, I got offense or defense this one, you know, and they're able to do a fair amount of getting us prepped. So if they're handling, you know, the scout team, they're also kind of prepping in practice. We plan practice together every day in terms of, you know, finalizing some of that. And I want them to find their voice. So I'll be like, hey, you got this segment. And they're running that. And that really kind of helps build their confidence and prepares them for that next step, which, and a lot of guys, it's, hey, it's trying to be a head coach, or if it's trying to move on to Division I, that's what we want to make sure we're helping do for our assistants here.
When you guys sit down and plan the practices together, what are those conversations like? Are you thinking about, let's say it's during the preseason, are you looking at what you did the previous day, what went well, what didn't go well? Do you have sort of a progression that you use in the preseason to kind of get you prepared for the season? Like, we have to get through X, Y, and Z by this day in order to make sure we have everything in. And obviously, the more you get things rolling in the offseason, the more prepared guys are coming in. Obviously, that varies. But just, what do you think about as you're doing your pre-practice prep with your staff? What are some of the conversations you're having?
Yeah, it's we do have a little bit of that checkpoint in terms of what we're trying to address. Hey, what didn't we get to yesterday? My current assistant, Pat Stasiak, has been doing a great job the last 2 years here. And he has been great in terms of like, hey, coach, you know, let's get this trail implemented, but make it live. Because that's the frustrating part about dealing with and coaching really smart, you know, student athletes, is that a lot of the times they'll learn to cheat that drill, and we can't keep them honest unless we're playing. So that's where we're getting a little bit more a handle on it. We're like, hey guys, this is why we're working on it, but to make sure that if they're really taking away a passing lane because they know we're trying to get it there, okay guys, you can rip it to the rim and score a layup if they're going to guard it that way. And so when we're planning practices, it's like, hey, what do we need to work on for the upcoming opponents that are going to help us? That's when we're in the midst of it during the season. But the preseason, as you mentioned, to just making sure we're ready to defend different types of screening actions. Offensively, you know, making sure we know our primary reads, our overplay options, and how to just play basketball. You know, so that's, I want to coach less during a season because our guys know how to play. And so like having some rules to our offense and being able to be like, hey, okay, what would you do next? Or like stopping and blowing the whistle dead. Hey, Tommy, what were you here? Like, what didn't you do? Oh, I didn't catch and see. I just put the ball down on the ground right away and you didn't see that open cutter for a layup, you know, or just having those little points of reference similar to that core foundation that'll help kind of develop their mindset and their basketball IQ is where you can really kind of have a jump.
I'm assuming that, especially with your guys, that coaching with questions is a pretty successful technique for what you like to do day in and day out.
Absolutely. Like, yeah, make it think it's their idea, a little of that assistant coach training, right?
Yep.
You know, so you know, make sure that the head coach is, you know, seeing that idea come up, or they created it. And that's what we want us, our players to do, is to have the light bulb go on, and then they're going to stick with it and believe in what they're doing.
How do you balance stopping play to make a coaching point or ask a question versus keeping the flow of the practice moving? Because I know that's something that, especially for young coaches, is sometimes difficult to manage in terms of, okay, there's 3, 4, 5 things that I just saw in this possession that I'd like to have go a different way or I'd like to fix, but you can't stop every single thing and hit on every single error or every single technicality. So how do you balance that out day in and day out on the practice floor?
Yeah, still trying, you know, like in terms of trying to figure that mess. But the reminder, like I like to give myself and you know, Pat and our staff, we're just try to keep it shorter. And, you know, when we really want to get into it. But the other piece is like to, you're going to get whatever you emphasize. So if, you know, your point is offensive rebounding this week or whatever you're trying to focus on, make that the point you're stopping for. And just to give that consistent message, because whatever you're emphasizing on an everyday basis, you're going to get that result. From my experience of coaching and beyond, it's just, and then just make sure you're emphasizing the things that are most important for your team at that time. And hopefully you're doing the right ones and it'll help you kind of progress as a team.
Preparing for an opponent, how much time are you spending watching film? How many game films do you watch? And what are some of the things that you're looking for when you're scouting an opponent that you then share with your players?
Okay. As a coach, is, you know, I give a lot of the scouting responsibility to our assistants, but it's, you know, trying to watch the last 4 games maybe, you know, and then our previous matchups and then being able to, you know, siphon that down to like, we want a 20-minute film session of trying to get, you know, what's going on with some of their actions, or, you know, if it's a little bit different, or their offensive movements, you know, anything that is important for us, anything defensively that they're doing, and then some of those special teams things. So it's, we think a lot of things are personal tendencies. So as we have a personnel segment as well, just to try to help our guys get a better feel for the opponents. And so you do all that. It's a pretty tight film session, but we know their attention span, to what they're really going to intake is limited. So it's to try to be precise and with it. So it's, you know, they got all types of classes going on, life as a college student. We need to make sure they're locked in for this 20-minute film and then be able to apply it again. So we try to watch film twice before we play an opponent, the day before and hopefully the day of, just to give our guys some chance to soak it in. But we play like an Ivy League schedule, so we play back-to-backs. So we'll play Friday night and Saturday afternoon. So it's important for us to try to like just force feed that information, especially for our Saturday opponents, because we are preparing for them earlier in the week, but we're not watching as much film on them. We're focused on that Friday opponent.
Are you usually watching the film before practice?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Before practice, sometimes we got a TV, you know, to bring on the court with us. Sometimes it's a quick transition, but we want to watch some of those actions before, you know, in personnel, so our guys can actually understand, and hopefully it helps our scout team and our current team or the some of the guys that are going to be playing on the floor, know what they're trying to do.
How hard is that emotional turnaround from Friday to Saturday, regardless of what the outcome is on Friday? Big win, tough loss, and now you got to turn around and play again the next day. I know that as a coach and as a player, part of me always liked when we had it. And we didn't have that all the time as a high school coach or high school player, and we almost never had it when I was playing in college. But I know that I used to like the idea of, hey, if we win, we get to keep it going on Saturday, and if we lose, boom, we can put it behind us and get our next game going. So just how do you handle that and talk to your players, and how do you handle it as a coach?
Yeah, it's great. Like in terms of, if you have a tough one, hey guys, best part, we play you know, less than about 12 hours. So it's, right. it's us trying to like, refocus on when we're going to, you know, get back to it. And if you have a good one, it's like, hey, great work today. Take the night. And we'll see you at shoot around tomorrow morning, you know, like, so it's, just like basketball, right? You're on to the next play, good or bad. You got to get on to the next one and not let it snowball. And so those are some of the things, and as a coach, it's great. Like my favorite thing to do is, you know, sometimes it's late at night, but I like to do a little bit of the laundry and I hang up the shooting shirts just because it's my little therapy. You get a little peace and quiet while the building shut down and just preparing, you know, the film downloaded and you're ready and just thinking through all the things that just happened and how you're going to be ready for tomorrow. So that's my little peace and quiet is hanging some laundry up in the night.
So do you process the Friday night game and then prepare for the Saturday game in between, or do you play the Friday game and then sort of immediately put that behind you, focus on Saturday, and then kind of come back to the Friday game after Saturday's over? I'm just curious.
Yeah, for the most part, it's unless there's something specific, it's kind of digest both. You know, like, hey, okay, we might take some – we have some game goals that we will try to, you know, calculate for our Friday game. But this year we had some injuries and some funky lineups kind of out there. So I was trying to go through, you know, what was working with some of these newer lineups that we didn't get to see as much. So I was trying to do a little bit of the Friday breakdown before Saturday. But that only was working because, you know, our assistant was able to prepare and have everything ready for that next opponent.
So, your analytics department had everything put together for you, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. We're working on that collaboration with our math department. So we're getting some independent studies out there.
That's cool. What are some things statistically, what are some things that you look at? Are there things that you feel like are important for your team, for your program to be successful? Are there things that directly correlate to wins and losses in your mind?
The possession game in terms of trying to, hey, if we don't really turn people over, it's not what we're able to do, but how are we going to make up some of these possessions? And the rebounding kind of battle, you know, the no rebounds, no rings thing is true in a lot of aspects for us, that since we don't create any creative, you know, tempo, and the 3-point shot is so, so powerful in this game. So to try to defend the arc and, you know, limit some of the opportunities that we can do. So those are some of the ones in valuing possession, you know, and trying to make sure we're not eliminating or limiting our offensive possessions. So making sure we're valuing the ball, defending the three, and trying to get some extra possessions on the glass.
How do you pace yourself over the course of the season, both you as a coach and then kind of trying to get a gauge on your team to make sure that they're staying fresh and that they're at their best when it's game time? Whether you want to talk about how you balance out practice during the week or just over the course of the season, just how do you manage your energy and manage the players' energy to make sure that you guys are always at your best come game day?
Yeah. That constant communication, you know, trusting your captains and having those talks with them, I think are very, very important. And something kind of COVID taught us, we practiced a little bit kind of less, and we had some split groups on a specific day, and that kind of helped us, you know, stay fresh, but still develop some skills and work on a few things that, you know, with some of these, we had just two groups on a day, and that really kind of helped us, I think, stay sharp throughout. And as we get further into February and hopefully playing into March, you don't want to play your best basketball in November. So that's kind of where offensively, when we're playing a little bit more of this motion, it's trying to adapt each year. So it's never going to be those same actions aren't going to work exactly as you want.
Right, right.
You know, it's not going to be completely foreign, but you're going to have to make some changes throughout. So to try to keep it fresh, it's, hey, you know, bringing in some different drills to work on the same skills. It's creating different scenarios, mixing up your lineups. But those split groups are trying to split a day where they're working a different muscle or, you know, that's different for them. I think that really helped our guys maintain focus.
All right, Ryan, we are coming up towards an hour and a half. So I want to ask you one final two-part question. Part one, when you look ahead over the next year or two, what do you see as being your biggest challenge? And then part two, when you think about what you get to do every day as the head men's basketball coach at Vassar, what brings you the most joy? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
Nice. Biggest challenge is, you know, replacing that bigger class right now in terms of, and just having, you know, like bringing in, I think we have 7 freshmen right now who are committed to come in next fall, which we're excited about, but it's, you know, just getting them up to speed and building those habits. And that's the biggest challenge, is to get them to play in our competitive Liberty League conference, which, you know, we have a lot of very solid teams. And then that's right up to our biggest joy, like in terms of watching them kind of have that progression in terms of what's going on in turn, like, hey, I know this now, you know, I've learned this, and to see them execute it in a, you know, practice and then in the game, and then to see their teammates believe in one another and to have that trust continue to blossom, I think is the part that is biggest joy. And then the individual joy for me is that the kids are starting to get to that little older age where they're, you know, rocking their Vassar gear or coming to practice yep. or, you know, knowing the players, they're invested, they're crying when we, you know, lose, or, you know, jumping up and down when we win, and just seeing, you know, them continue to mature and love our program just as much as our players. That brings me a ton of joy.
That's cool and very well said. I think if you can incorporate your family into your program, obviously you've taken it even one step further to bring that joy. And that's really what it's all about, and being able to have that impact on your players like we've talked about throughout the episode. Before we get out, I want to give you a chance, Ryan, to share how people can connect with you, find out more about your program. So whether you want to share social media, email, website, whatever you feel comfortable with. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, thank you again, Mike, for the time.
Absolutely.
To get in contact with me, my email is rme@vassar.edu. I also have a Twitter at Coach Me. It's Coach and then M-E-E is my Twitter handle. And that's some of the best ways of getting in contact with us. And yeah, Poughkeepsie, New York. It's about an hour and a half north of New York City. And beautiful little town and campus, and it's a great place, and fortunate enough to be here with my wife India and my 2 kids. It's been quite an honor to be here, and then obviously an honor tonight to be able to speak with you. I've always enjoyed your podcast.
Well, thank you very much. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule tonight. It's been a lot of fun getting to learn more about you and your basketball journey and your program there at Vassar. And I know you're going to have a ton of success moving forward. So thank you for that. We really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies. And most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.